breakfast puppies?
This podcast contains adult language and content and is meant for mature audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
Hi, I'm Kevin Sambita of Palladium Books, and you're listening to The Glitter Boys.
So, it's Just Jacob, along here with Matthew, an NPC, and we're back with Kevin from Palladium. Today, we're talking about the glorious history of Heroes Unlimited. And I got questions, Kevin. I got so many questions, especially, and since we started having these conversations, the questions have just grown because I knew you were into comic books. I did not realize how much of a fiend you were back in the day and how far your fingers had gone in the field and all of the connections you had. So let's just start there. Where did the nucleus for doing a Heroes role-playing game start over there at Palladium Books?
You know, strangely enough, it kind of came a few years into the release of our first game. Everyone assumed that my first game would be a superhero game because I loved comic books. As you mentioned, Jacob, I was kind of dabbling in the field. I knew lots of comic book people. In the 1970s, Detroit was sort of a hub for comic books. And the running joke at Marvel Comics, in fact, was that all the new talent comes from Metro Detroit. They get work in New York and move to L.A. And because it did. I mean, Terry Austin came from there. Richard Buckler came from there. Tom Orzechowski, who's a letterer, would go on to work for Todd McFarlane and Spawn, and a whole lot of others. I mean, Jim Starlin, the guy who created Thanos, you know, all kinds of people came from this area. Keith Pollard, Arville Jones, Al Milgrom. I mean, there's just a gazillion guys. If I recall correctly, I think even Walt Simonson came from a neighboring city. So, and that was cool for me because it made comic books seem like my breaking into comics could be a reality, because all these guys I knew were breaking into the industry. I mean, I personally knew Terry Austin, not well, but I mean, I knew Terry. Tom Orzechowski was actually something of a mentor to me and Alex, as was Arville Jones. So, you know, it seemed like a very real thing that could happen. And, you know, I had talent. It was awesome. And plus, you get to hear these guys' stories, you know, and you see their origin story. Like, we saw Jim Starlin's, Alex and I saw Jim Starlin's portfolio before Marvel did. Because he was fresh out of the army, and there's this young guy. He's in fatigues. I mean, older than us by a few years, I think. And we certainly had that impression. And he's like, "Hey guys," he's at this little comic book convention that a buddy of mine, Mike Kacharski, had thrown, called Tricon. And it's like the last day of the convention. We're all like kind of closing up, getting ready to go home. And he's like, "Hey guys, you know, I heard you guys talking and you're comic book fans and artists yourselves. Could you take a look at my portfolio and see what you know, you think of it?" And we're like, "Yeah, sure, buddy." And we look at this and we're like, "Holy cow, this is amazing." Because he was super talented, right? And very dynamic art style. And then we saw him like 6 months later at another convention. We're like, "Jim, how did it go? Did you get work?" And he goes, "No." And we're like, "No." He's like, "Well, can I show you my new portfolio?" Because he went to Marvel and he said, "Hey, kid, you draw really well. We really like your style, but this is all original material. We want to see if you can draw Marvel characters."
Yeah. Okay.
So his new portfolio was filled with like Spider-Man and Captain America and everybody else. So we're like, "Oh man, it's just better than ever." So, I mean, that was just, you know, very cool, you know, the big convention here back in the day was the Detroit Triple Fanfare, which was pretty amazing. It was one of the first multimedia conventions. So, for example, I got to meet Gene Roddenberry and hear some of his stories. I got to meet George Romero, the guy who created The Living Dead. And in like 1971 or 72, you know, he brings the uncut version of everyone has seen now, but he brings the uncut version of Night of the Living Dead. Plus, we get to see this new movie that's coming out soon called The Crazies. We were the first to see it like 2 months before it was released. And, you know, we get to hear his story. We get to ask questions. You know, we get to walk up and chit-chat with him a little bit. It was, you know, and here's another guy who, small-time filmmaker, makes his movie, you know, on a short budget in Pennsylvania. And so all of this is like, man, we can do this. We can be creators like all these guys. So that was all an early inspiration. And then, strangely enough, with Heroes Unlimited, it would be the third big RPG release from Palladium, because, you know, I got involved in role-playing with fantasy and got caught up in the whole fantasy thing. And then we did Mechanoids as a small thing to release, as we discussed in an earlier episode. And just people were like, Kev, you're not coming out with a superhero game? And I'm like, it's percolating, man. It's percolating. And all these other games came out and people are like, dude, you're too late. Mm. You know, there's like 14, 15 different, you know, superhero role-playing games out there, you know, and I'm like, it's just not there. And then finally, I don't know, things just started to click and I knew what I wanted to do. I really do. A lot of times ideas really do what I call percolate. I mean, I can feel them in the back of my head, and it's just kind of developing. And at some point, boom, we're ready. It's ready to release. And then once the ideas came, I mean, it poured out of me and came up with Heroes Unlimited.
Yeah. Let it cook.
That's right.
When did you start like putting pen to paper on it?
I had made notes, so I'm a note guy. So I'm always making notes on stuff. In fact, it was funny. You know, I have my copies here, even though it's an audio podcast. I have copies I can show you guys of stuff.
Yeah, I have to side note there that we do have some people that were leaving comments like, I want to see all these pictures. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, maybe someday.
Yeah.
Maybe someday. And to those folks, I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead. No, go ahead.
No, I'm just saying to everybody who is really craving to see these things. Unfortunately, this is just an audio only format, but we'll do our best to share what we can.
Absolutely.
So I had a bunch of papers sticking out of my early Heroes Unlimited, first edition Heroes Unlimited. And I'm like, what the heck's this stuff? I should take this stuff out. And one's a bunch of notes from a fan. One's some notes from my ex-wife, Marianne. And then there's this, which, as you can see, is a handwritten.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
You know, and it's notes for ninjas and super spies. It says espionage agent, OCC, cyber agent, gadgeteer agent, operative agent, wired agent. And then there's like freelance OCC. And it's like, you know, thief free agent, professional. And then there's like mercenary OCC, which I don't think even made it into the book. It's like cyborg soldier, academy officer, ex-commando, veteran grunt, gizmo tier, dreamer gizmo tier. That didn't make it to the book. I don't think.
Nope.
Thinker gizmo tier, gizoid. God knows what that is. Gizmo tier. You know, it's kind of fun finding these little, you know, blasts from the past. And you know, that's something too we haven't talked about, but in those early days, I mean, I didn't get a computer until I think it was Robotech, the first book I did on a computer. So all this shit is handwritten. And I'm really happy. I was really happy once Eric convinced me to get and Marianne convinced me to get a computer, because you had to really think things through and have a tight outline. Mm-hmm. And even then you're cutting pieces of paper out and pasting it in an earlier section or a later section. And, you know, and then poor Marianne had to read, or someone else, some other sucker had to read my chicken scratch and type it all in when we were typesetting it. And so I was making notes on various things, mostly superpowers and the character categories in Heroes Unlimited. Like I knew I wanted to have a super soldier category and mutants, of course. Mm-hmm. I was a huge X-Men fan before it was really popular to be an X-Men fan. And I had all kinds of notes on that stuff. But I didn't really start writing it until after Palladium Fantasy came out in 83. And then Heroes Unlimited came out in 1984.
Yeah.
In time for, I think, a Gen Con release. And it did really well right away. You know, just kept rocking and rolling after that.
That is freaking amazing that like you had all those strands percolating simultaneously and they came out in what? About less than
1 year, 2 years, 3 years.
Yeah.
A year
later. Yeah.
Well, so going back to a discussion from our previous episode about the last minute cover of the Monsters and Animals book.
Oh, yeah.
This looks to be the opposite. You've got just this epic four-color style piece on the cover the first Heroes Unlimited.
Yeah, by Jim Steranko, who, you know, is a legend and was certainly, like, at the peak of his game back then. And a lot of people asked me how we got Jim Steranko. And I said, well, you know, I had my buddy Alex Marcinison, who's a great researcher. I don't know how he finds half the stuff he does, especially back in the day before computers. Mm-hmm. I said, Al, I need to track down Jim Steranko. And he was like, okay. And like 2 days later, it's like, here's Steranko's telephone number.
Nice.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Darn.
So I called Jim Steranko and we chit-chatted for a while, told him what we do. He had no idea what a role-playing game is. I don't think he still really knows what a role-playing game is. And he's like, well, I want $3,000. And I said, oof, but you know, you're a legend. And he was a huge influence on my own art style development. I love Jim Steranko's Captain America and Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. Huge inspiration to me. And I'm like, great, let's do it. And he turned in that original iconic, gorgeous, one of my favorite covers of all time, really. Mm-hmm. And it's classic Jim Steranko. And again, you know, part of that was a marketing thing. I sat back and went, I want people to look at this and go, wow, I recognize this artist. Because how you know, again, there were 14 role-playing games out, maybe even 20 that were all based on superheroes, including by that point, Marvel superheroes.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, how do I stand out? You know, let's hire a legend to do the damn cover. Mm-hmm. And hopefully people will take a look at it and like what they see. And they did. You know, Mike Gustavich did a bunch of art in it as well. Mm-hmm. And my old comic book buddy, and you know, it stood out, and you know, 40 years later, it's one of the few superhero games that have stood the test of time. So
yeah, it's unlike a lot of others, it's still there.
Yeah.
You know, and I think there's some clunky stuff to it. You know, I think you know, I was still experimenting, so it's a little different from Palladium Fantasy. It uses the same basic core rules, but you know, the educational system is different and I think a little too complicated, you know, compared to later games like Beyond the Supernatural and Dead Rain, where you know, you have ordinary people and occupations very condensed with clear skills. You know, I like to give people options, but I think I gave them a little too much options in that regard. But you know, it's good stuff. The superpowers are great, the superpower categories are great. People love those, so you know, but I'm always experimenting and trying to push the envelope and do, you know, cool different things.
I have a question about the character creation systems that were included in here. I have only ever seen the revised and the second edition, but in the revised, which was heavily referenced in our gaming group, there's the same BioE system from the Ninja Turtles. Mm-hmm. It was in there. Was that in the first edition as well?
No.
Okay.
It was introduced in the seventh printing. Is that correct?
That sounds about right.
Yeah.
Yeah. A year later, we'd come out with Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. And I just, you know, Eric's BioE rules were just so clean and nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, when we did the revised edition with a new Steranko cover, Jim Steranko cover, I decided to incorporate those aspects in there.
How was it received as you like brought your game forth into this crowded area of other superhero games at the time?
I did real well. Mm-hmm. I think it was really pretty different. I mean, while there were like 14 or 20 other games, you know, the big three, and we were sort of number four, were what? The Marvel superhero game,
mm-hmm. by
Villains and Vigilantes, Champions, which never gets the credit it deserves, and Heroes Unlimited. Those are the big four. And, you know, Villains and Vigilantes, who I knew Jeff D, who created that. I think it was a pretty sweet game, but it kind of lost momentum when Champions came out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Marvels and Champions were sort of the big thing. And Champions had come out a year or two before Heroes Unlimited. And again, I say they don't get the credit they deserve because, and we had touched on this in an earlier episode too, is everyone, there were these strong preconceived notions about what you could and couldn't do in gaming.
Yeah.
And one of them was that science fiction, fantasy, that's it. You can't do anything else. And it has to all be generic. And Champions comes out, and it was kind of generic, but the rules were very different and unique. And I thought their comic book art, their art was, I didn't think it was very good, mm-hmm. but it had that strong comic book vibe, and it just really took off. And I think with that release, it helped really drive home that, hey, we don't have to limit ourselves to superheroes and or to fantasy and science fiction, which I knew from the beginning, because I mean, my game was designed to incorporate everything. And I'm like, finally, people are seeing the light. Mm-hmm. But still, it took another, you know, 10 years or at least 6-8 years before people started to fool around with, you know, things like Shadowrun and Vampire the Masquerade. And that's when, like, I think in Rifts came out around that same time, and everyone went, oh, wow, you can do wildly different and unique mm-hmm. settings. And it's like, yes, I've been trying to tell you that for 10 years.
One interesting thing that when I was reviewing Heroes Unlimited for this episode that really I was reminded of, and one of the reasons I was a huge Heroes Unlimited fan, is many of the role-playing games that came out during the 80s, and even a few from the late 70s, they chose what their base power level was going to be, and really honed in on that power level. And if you went outside that narrow band of what they set up, it could get real clunky to be able to run a game that had both Superman and the Punisher in it simultaneously.
I've experienced this with Marvel superhero back in the day, the old one, when you had somebody whose powers were all considered beyond. You know, you got a Silver Surfer running around with a Hawkeye, and you're like, <don't> no. <know." laughs>
And Heroes Unlimited did a really, really good job. And a lot of it is because of the Palladium game system and the skill system of being able to throw, you know, your God tier level supers side by side with a professional stage magician who also solves crime and it actually works. Yeah. And that has always been why I've said, you want to run a superheroes game? Go take a look at Heroes Unlimited, because there's some real, real cool ability to bring those very different genres and styles. And hats off to you again for managing to pull that off.
I don't know if you're aware of that, but we say this a lot as in this podcast, of that this is one of the few systems, the Palladium system, where the Vagabond can stand next to the baby dragon and still have something, or dragon hatchling, and still have something to bring to the table.
Yeah.
You know, and that's wonderful. We love that.
Thanks. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's very deliberate. It's, again, this gets back to my comic book roots and, you know, my love of all kinds of fiction and heroes. So I loved, you know, super powerful characters are cool, but I loved Batman. I loved mm-hmm. Spider-Man. I loved Daredevil and Captain America. You know, how do you make them fit? And you know, again, for me, it's all about character and story. So I always tried to find ways to make even what some people, what power gamers certainly would consider a lesser character,
yeah,
unique and interesting and have something to contribute to the game. And, you know, obviously a game master who's just into, you know, power gaming, you know, your Hawkeye character or your Daredevil character is going to get squished like a bug.
Yep.
But if you have a game master who's trying to bring about superheroes and the whole wide range of these characters, it's there, and you just have to be careful. And then as a game master, you need to give each of those heroes, or each of those players, you know, their moment to shine. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, the Wasp, I mean, talk about someone who gets squished like a bug. Literally. you know, it's, but, you know, she works in the comics, and if you pay attention and you know, she works in you know, a role-playing game as well, and characters like her. So I wanted to give people a wide range. You know, and again, I adored comic books, and I wanted to give them the full range and the full experience of playing whatever kind of character they happen to, you know, pick, whether it's a Tony Stark in Power Armor or a super soldier like Captain America, or, you know, a sleuth and badass like Batman. You know, I wanted to give them everything.
Mm-hmm. So, speaking of flying characters, that leads me to my, I wouldn't say favorite, but the most memorable piece of art from this book is this throwaway little piece on page 166 of Revised of a character that in my old circles we called B-Guy. B-Guy was the most recurring villain in every game we played. Because for some reason, the GM was like, and ultimately the mastermind of everything is B-Guy. And we're like, God damn it, not B-Guy again.
Why not?
Yep.
I actually think that piece of art, was that by any chance given to you as like a line drawing? Because I think it's been used in a couple different fellows.
I know I've seen him with a grenade.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, definitely line art.
So, you published the original Heroes Unlimited. How was it received?
It was very well received. You know, people really liked it. And like I said, I think it stood out because it was different than anything else that was out there. I think the art really resonated with people as well. And I think people liked the idea that you could play these characters that had, you know, human foibles. And, you know, I think they reflected comic books. I mean, they weren't just cardboard characters where it's like, I'm Super Bob and I have the power to, you know, of invulnerability and to turn into the Human Torch. And it's like, okay, that's cool, but you got more nuance here. You got, you know, and can you do a Tony Stark Iron Man? You know, I don't think some of those other games incorporated those elements very well. And then, you know, I mean, we kind of jumped past sort of my background in comics, but I mean, I read pretty much everything out there. So I was familiar with Wally Wood's Thunder Agents and, you know, the D&D or D&D, the DC Comics, you know, their whole lineup and Marvel. You know, I lived, ate, breathed Marvel. And I mean, I even read the Archie comic book stuff with Flyman and the Shield and characters like that. And so, I mean, I was just immersed in comic bookness, you know, plus I knew a lot of other guys who were trying to create their own comics and talked about, you know, the elements of heroic adventure and all that kind of stuff. And then I dabbled in addition to knowing all kinds of different people. Alex and I produced a comic book called A Plus. It was a black and white anthology that came out in the 1970s. What most people would think of today as an alternative black and white comic, something that, you know, we were 10 years too early. You know, 10 years later, Eastman and Laird and a bunch of other people would come out with black and white comics that just took off.
Yeah.
So sometimes it's not good to be ahead of your time, but, you know, and we had all kinds of cool stuff in there that didn't go anywhere. And then I had dabbled in comics. I had done some work for Noble Comics, which are the guys who did Justice Machine and Cobalt Blue. Mm-hmm. I had done some work with B.K. Taylor, who was at the time sort of a hotshot with National Lampoon. He was doing Timberland Tales and The Appletons, I think was the name of the comics. It's just some goofy three-page stuff that was hilarious. And, you know, so I actually did some Topps trading card bubblegum design science fiction stuff, you know, aliens and monsters and ghosting under Bob because it was his assignment, but he needed help.
Oh, I know that ghosting under somebody else's assignment very well.
Yep, there you go.
That's all my work in the industry has been, is like.
Well, and that was, you know, unknown to most people, I'm actually unofficially a Marvel comic book artist because I ghosted on a couple of issues of the Defenders.
Ooh.
Again, my buddy, Mike Gustavich, I forget who the artist was, but Mike was inking the book at the time, and he needed help. So he reached out to me and said, Kev, you know, do you have time? And I'm like, yeah, sure, absolutely. Are you kidding me?
I have to ask because our people will ask us, our fans will ask, what episodes so that they can buy them on the used market? Because they're going to want to know.
I don't even remember. Oh, you know, no. At the time, it was just bang it out. It's something in the 80s, early 80s, mid 80s. It was crazy. Like I said, I forget who the artist is. And I'm expecting to get tight pencils. And these are like rough layouts. And I'm like, holy shit. So, I mean, I got to like draw Valkyrie and, you know, these other characters. It's like, so first I'd have to go in and tighten up the pencils and then I'd have to ink it. I could see why Mike needed a hand because this guy was just super, super loose. And, you know, and at the time it was just sort of a job.
Yeah.
In between. I mean, I did pick up those issues, but I like I said, I don't remember.
Oh no.
You know, what they were. And I didn't get any of the original pages, or if I did, they're long gone. Because Gustavich would have been cool and sent them to me, but I don't know. Mm-hmm. But it was just like this little blip. Like I said, it's a couple issues. Mm-hmm. But that was cool. I mean, like, yes, I'm about to break into comics big time. And then right around, so it had to be like around the time Heroes Unlimited came out. It had to be like 80, 85. Because what happened is why I never broke into comics is my company just took off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I was actually about to ask, you're still doing side jobs at this point. When did Palladium become like your only means of income? Like when did it become supporting to you in a way that you kind of you focused into it as opposed to into the world?
1984, 1985. So a couple of funny stories is I asked Marianne to marry me in 1983, and we're living in this little two-bedroom house with her two kids. And, you know, one of the bedrooms is my library. The dining room is my art studio. you know, because I decided I was going to put all of my attention into Palladium with the release of Palladium Fantasy in 83. Mm-hmm. So I was making a decent income doing freelance work. And then I decided to put all my attention into the company. So I'm pulling down like, I don't know, $6,000 or $8,000, you know, 1983 dollars, which is barely survivable for one human being.
Yeah.
And I ate a lot of, in fact, I have trouble eating macaroni and cheese and bologna because I would eat that like all the time. I mean, a box of mac and cheese at the time was like 32 cents.
Yeah. Yep.
And I ate so much of that I can't eat mac and cheese. Mm. So Marianne was the breadwinner. You know, she was working as a computer data inputter, I think for an insurance company. You know, so when I asked her to marry her, I said, and Marianne, I want you to understand that if everything goes according to plan, I mean, I've plotted all this out, I've calculated everything. And, you know, by the end of next year, 1984, I should be making about $90,000 a year. And she leaned over and kissed me on the cheek and said, I'll marry you anyway.
Aww.
Because she didn't think it was real, right? She didn't think it would happen. And, you know, a year later, I'm not Palladium. I'm personally grossing $90,000. Mm-hmm. And the company is really starting to take off. And I'm like, you know, awesome.
Yeah.
But, you know, this gets back into the realm. I forget if I told the story in the early episode, if we said wait. So in 1984, another friend of mine, Janelle Jacois. So we worked together at Judges Guild.
Mm-hmm.
I shouldn't say together because we were in different states. I think Janelle was in Ohio. But, I mean, we talked on the phone a lot. And we were Judges Guild's two top artists.
Yeah.
When I quit Judges Guild, I went off to focus all my energy into Palladium Books. And Janelle did a couple other things with Judges Guild and then did some stuff with some other companies and fell into Coleco as one of their main artists. And so in 1984, I'm at Gen Con and Janelle shows up and she had already offered me a position to be like her main artist creative guy at Coleco. And she comes and makes this offer again and says, Kev, I really want you. We'll pay you $38,000 a year. And you'll only go up from there. We'll give you a $10,000 moving, you know, bonus that you can use to move and whatever else you want to do. You know, and this is just before Palladium is really starting to take off.
Mm-hmm.
I had just released, like I said, I debuted Heroes Unlimited at Gen Con. And I'm like, what, Janelle? And leave all of this? And I swing my arms out and I look down at my table and there's like 8 products.
Yeah.
And she smiles and says, think about it. Talk about it with your wife. And
that's so rough.
You know, so it's one of those things like what happened? What would have happened if I had taken that job?
The great, you know, Cabbage Patch crash would have gotten you.
Ninja Turtles, Robotech, none of that would have happened.
None of that would have happened.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, same thing. Jim Steranko just earlier that year was a weird year for me because all these people are offering me work. You know, Jim Steranko, he's got this great voice. He sounds like Darth Vader. And it's like, Kevin, I want you to join me. I want you to be my manager.
Those of you listening at home, that was Kevin Sambita talking into a mug. That was fantastic.
And to me, Steranko was an art god.
Yeah.
And so it meant the world to me that he wanted me to be part of his team and to be his, you know, basically his right hand man, and help manage him and his company, Super Graphics. You know, he's like, yeah, think about it. And I'm like, Jim, I don't need to think about it. I said, I'm so honored, but you know, I have my own dreams and my stuff I want to do, and I have to say no. And he gave me one of the greatest compliments of all time for me. Again, especially from coming from a guy who I adored and loved his art. It was a profound influence on me. And he says, well, Kevin, I would have been disappointed if you took the job. And I'm like, what? And he's like, Kevin, you're one of these rare talents who not only are you super creative, but you are a good business person. That's what I want you. You know, and I'm like, wow. And, you know, and at the time, I'm 28, 30 years old. And, you know, this legendary guy just, you know, said that to me, and you know, he wishes me well. And we stayed buddies for, God, at least a decade.
Mm-hmm.
Where we would talk like every other week, which was pretty awesome. So, you know, it's like, yeah, what if I had taken that job for Jim Steranko? What if I had taken the job at Coleco? Everything might have been different. Yeah, especially to win no Turtles, probably no Robotech. Probably would have never met Kevin Long. All that stuff happened later. So, you know, would have moved away from Eric Widjic.
Mm, yeah.
But a couple of factors. One, I really knew what I wanted to do with my life and where I wanted to take the company. And two, my mom was battling cancer and like death's door. So I had to, I didn't want to leave her. Mm-hmm. So
I want to bring this back to Gustavich. You had talked about doing some shadow work for him earlier. Yeah. And I believe Gustavich's art features very heavily in the first of the Heroes Unlimited source books.
Yeah, and not only does it factor heavily in the first Heroes Unlimited source book, which was Justice Machine, mm-hmm. but it was Palladium's first licensed property. This was originally a comic book that Mike created. He established a company called Noble Comics. And again, Mike's a sweet guy, and he knows his talent. So, you know, I go to hang out at his studio for a weekend. He brought a bunch of people in. It was like his house out, I forget where, probably Ohio. And, you know, there's guys who would go on to become big-time comic book people, like, what is his name, Bill Reinhold. He would go on to do mm-hmm. a bunch of great stuff for Marvel. Bill Willingham, who would go on to write Fables for DC Comics. Create the Elementals. It was great. You know, all this talent. Jeff D was there. Some other folks were there. You know, it was good stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, that was exciting. And so Mike gave me my first, again, it was an alternative publishing company, but, you know, my first comic book job was doing the colors for his Justice Machine comic book.
Nice. So, that trail of you've known Gustavich, you used Gustavich in Heroes Unlimited. How did you decide that this was going to be our first supplement?
I just really liked Justice Machine, and I forget whether I went to Mike or if Mike went to me and said, "Hey, Kev," I think I went to Mike and said, "You know, Mike, I love your Justice Machine. Can I do a role playing game?" Mm-hmm. And he said, "Yeah, absolutely." And in fact, you know, we kind of crossed the streams because, you know, the Cobalt Blue and Justice Machine number 5 came out in 1982, I think. And 1983, and the Mechanoids appeared in the Cobalt Blue. It was a double, double cover flip comic. And, you know, my Mechanoids were there because they thought they were cool and said, "Kev, I want to bring in your Mechanoids." And I'm like, okay.
Oh, that's heck awesome.
Yeah.
Oh, in color, too.
Yeah. My colors, by the way.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
And, you know, there's a runner.
Oh, yeah.
Parents and, you know, so.
Okay, so real quick, which issue is that so people can track it down?
It's Justice Machine. Like I said, it's a double issue. Half the book is Justice Machine. Half the book is Cobalt Blue. And Cobalt Blue was never as big as Justice Machine. So it's Justice Machine number 5 and Cobalt Blue number 5. They're the same book. And the Mechanoids appeared in Cobalt Blue.
Awesome.
So you got the license to do Justice Machine in 83?
We got that in 85.
85.
The comic book came out in 83.
Right, right.
And I mean, Justice Machine and Cobalt Blue 5, I think, were the last Noble Comic issues.
Right, because the license went to Texas Comics in 83. And then in 86 got shifted over to Comico. So I was just trying to line things up and.
I mean, so many people have taken a run at Justice Machine. It's not mm-hmm. funny.
Oh, yeah. You look at it and I'm fairly certain the Wikipedia page on it's out of date because it shows like 8 different publishers go, you know, and I'm first thinking they're missing one or two that never actually managed to put an issue out, but own the IP.
Yeah. There's a new guy who owns both those properties now. You know, he's talking about bringing Justice Machine and Cobalt Blue back, but you know, we'll see. I guess he bought Justice Machine a couple of years ago and, he's talking about doing some kind of Kickstarter relaunch of some of the old stuff and then doing new stuff. But I think it's still sort of a plan in the works. And yeah, it's cool. So the cool thing for people who are fans of Justice Machine, you know, all 15 of you out there, the source book has never before seen material because Mike just let me run with it. He would, we'd have these long conversations and he'd give me some of his ideas. And then we would run and he would let me run off and do all kinds of stuff. So there's more information about Jor-El, the world that they come from, and some of the characters and stuff. It was very fun. And of course, the mechanoids.
Yeah.
Make an appearance in that as well.
they tend to work their way into a lot of books that you've...
Yeah. So how many supplements did you do before the 90s for Heroes Unlimited? Because I was trying to sort that out and I got lost in a rabbit hole of printing years of print runs and that sort of thing.
Not too many. I mean, Villains Unlimited.
Yep.
I think that came out in the late 80s. And actually says 1992. So not many. So what happened is, you know, Palladium Fantasy was one of my main interests. And then Turtles came out, and that was a runaway hit. And thankfully, I had Eric to work on most of those. Mm-hmm. And then Robotech was our next big hit that came out. So we had like 83 was Palladium Fantasy, 84 was Heroes Unlimited, 85 was TMNT and Other Strangeness, 87 was Robotech. We just had this slew, you know, 88 was Ninjas and Super Spies. And I think 89 was Beyond the Supernatural. Meanwhile, I'm working on riffs sort of behind the scenes for, you know, from like 87 to 90. So we sort of had a lot going. And Robotech, you know, that was our next big hit. So it was nice because I had Eric working on Turtles, which was a hit. I had Robotech, that was a hit that I was working on. Mm-hmm. And then kind of doing other stuff. I mean, I got nicknamed the Machine by Ryan Dancy of WotC.
Fair.
Because I was writing 8 to 12 books a year.
Yeah.
So, you know, I sort of was a machine. Yeah.
So let's switch gears at this point and talk about Ninjas and Super Spies. And even though we're jumping over a couple things in the chronology of your product run, but they're, you know, Robotech and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles are so epic that they're like, we're going to put an entire session to each of those in their own right, because they were genre defining for both the genres they came out of and for role playing in such a way. So we're going to pull those out, and just so listeners don't, we're not forgetting about them. I had heard a story at one point that Ninjas and Super Spies was percolating all the way back in 84, and some of the first ideas were getting thrown around for it. And can you basically tell us where that started and how it developed into its own thing?
I sure can. So that was very much an Eric Woodjick idea. He wanted to do some kind of martial arts game. He loved Heroes Unlimited. He was involved in some of my playtests with Heroes Unlimited. And he was a big Champions fan. So he liked that genre. And he himself had dabbled in various martial arts. Like he had, I think he was like a second degree something in Kendo. And he was, had studied Aikido for a while and something else. And so he was very familiar with martial arts and thought it would be great to do some kind of martial arts game. And then like you, Jacob, I'm a James Bond fan. And I said, you know, it would be great, Eric, if we made it like, you know, martial arts and super spies. Mm-hmm. Like James Bond, only we could or Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., mm-hmm. you know, take it to that next level. And Eric really liked that idea. So, you know, and Eric, you know, he's legendary for having banged out the actual writing for TMNT in 4.5 weeks. But that's like an aberration for him, very much an anomaly. And I think that was possible only because he and I had been discussing it for like 6 months and what we would do, what we felt needed to be in the game. So when he had to jump in, it just flowed out. So something most people don't know is poor Eric suffered from manic depression.
Yeah.
And he didn't want to take meds for it because he said it just evened him out too much. He liked the highs. He hated the lows. But he goes, when you're on meds, everything's just kind of flat. Yeah. And so you have a great idea, but you don't really feel it. You can't really tell. And you have a shitty idea. You know, again, you can't really tell. And so there would be years at a time, especially later in his life in the 90s, where nothing, you'd see nothing from Eric. And then all of a sudden he hit a manic phase. And the problem with that is he'd have ideas for 30 different things.
Right.
And yeah. he was working on all 30 of them. And it was hard to rein him in and get him to focus on finishing any one project. But when he didn't, he also kind of hamstrung himself with, he was one of those guys who always felt, okay, this is great. The next thing I do has to be even better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And let's face it, one of the first things published ever from him was Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and Other Strangeness.
Yeah. It's a hard follow.
It's hard to outdo Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and Other Strangeness. I mean, he was almost a victim of his own success. So he kind of would hamstring himself with that. I gotta outdo myself every single time. So I think that really worked against him. But the guy was just this creative powerhouse. I mean, he was a true genius in game design. And we would talk about game theory and, you know, ideas about everything. I would drive my ex-wife crazy because Eric, would, you know, we lived very close. So I'd go visit Eric or he'd visit me. And, you know, 5 hours later, I'm coming into the house. It's, you know, midnight or 1 a.m. She's like, well, did you guys get a lot of work done on Ninja and Super Spies? And I'm like, well, no, actually, we forgot to talk about it. And she'd be like, what the hell? What were you talking about for 5 hours out there? And I'm like, like this and that. And we got ideas for a couple new cool books and source books. Because everything, Eric and I were like these two guys who just, everything gave us ideas. Mm-hmm. I mean, everything. Like, I came up with the idea for the Zytikics and Rifts. I was at a park, and I was just watching these bees coming and going from their mud hive. And it just gave me the idea that, like, what if you had these alien insects? And, you know, we have these levels. They fly out one level. They fly in the next level. And, you know, where does that go? I mean, how stupid? I mean, it's just... You're watching bugs, but go ahead. Yeah, Matt.
Could we get the definitive pronunciation of that one more time for our listeners?
Zytikics.
There it is. Zytikics. Excellent.
My dad called them city chicks.
I have to go pay somebody $20 from like a decade ago now.
As you guys have probably noted, most of the time I try to have names that are very pronounceable. That was a Kevin Long idea. Their look, and he came up with the name, and I said, sure, Kev, we'll use that. His idea for the name. And I wish I didn't, because nobody can pronounce it. And Zytikics. Sambida.
Those are honestly the big two that we get more than anything else.
I think so.
Yeah, I'm sure. I answered anything with an S sound except for shithead.
Right.
You know, because it's one of those crazy Polish names, and I'm always amazed when someone gets it right.
Yeah.
That's okay. Kevin is fine.
You know, we start to see some of Kevin Long's art here in Ninjas and Super Spies too. Mm-hmm. Is that? No, because this is advanced a little bit.
Yeah, it's 1988.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Was the same art used across the original Ninjas and Super Spies and the revised edition?
Yeah, we kept most of that. I mean, we probably added some, but yeah.
The one real impressive thing about Ninjas and Super Spies is you can take any action movie from the 80s and run it in Ninjas and Super Spies. Literally, like any of the return to Vietnam genre that was around there, grab the veteran grunt, grab the academy officer, et cetera, et cetera. Any James Bond movie, there's an agent class in there that'll mate up with any character. You know, the 80s was also the when ninjas were suddenly super popular. You had multiple television shows that had ninjas in them. They all dabbled into espionage. It in so many ways, Ninjas and Super Spies is like this weird love letter to the pop culture of mercenary films and martial arts films and secret agent films that were going on at the time. And it has stood up so well for modeling that set of genres and how often those genres crossed over. It's just impressive.
Yeah. Well, I mean, again, it's just stuff that we love.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we do our books, a lot of these things are love letters to a particular genre. And, you know, I often joke that I don't have eclectic taste. I have epileptic taste because I'm kind of all over the place. And, you know, and I was, I guess, a big pop culture kid. Mm-hmm. You know, I was really fortunate because my mom loved books. She's the one who instilled into me the love of books, because she's like, Kevin, you know, you can go anywhere, be anything. You read these books, they transport you to, you know, other parts of the country, other times, other worlds. And I loved that. And she was a voracious reader. And then my dad was a film buff. You know, he grew up in the 40s, and he was like sort of an only child. He had brothers and sisters, but he was the child of a second marriage. Mm-hmm. You know, most of his brothers and sisters were 10, 12 years older. So, and his mom died sadly when he was 12, and his dad was off, you know, either working or he was apparently this great sax player. And so he'd be out at bars and clubs and stuff. So my dad was left kind of alone to kind of run the streets. And fortunately, he was into baseball and movies. So the minute he got, you know, a dime back then, apparently, to see a movie, and, you know, you're talking double features plus, you know, six or eight cartoons and, you know, a news trailer. And my dad would go to see movies. And so he loved movies. And, you know, me growing, you know, I was born in 1956. So, you know, I'm coming into things in the 1960s and 70s. And TV is rerunning all these old, you know, movies with Humphrey Bogart and Cary Grant and all this stuff. And my dad would be like, oh, you're going to love this, you know, and all the Thin Man. It's a great series. And, you know, oh, Dad, you know, most people don't even realize that Blondie newspaper strip.
Mm-hmm.
Hell, most people don't even know about the Blondie newspaper strip these days. But Blondie and Dagwood were a huge radio show. And then they did a whole series of it has to be at least a dozen Blondie and Dagwood movies that are just, I mean, I love them because my dad, when they started to rerun them along with like the Bowery Boys and, you know, that kind of mom and pa kettle, mm-hmm. you know, they were great stuff. My dad's like, oh, I loved these when I was a kid. And, you know, and of course my dad, you know, we were close. So I'm like, oh yeah, let's see what my dad loved. And they were great stuff. And I just loved stories. I love stories and cool characters and interesting characters and all kinds of stories. And so between my mom and my dad, you know, I'm a movie buff. I love to read, you know, and they thought comic books were cool. They were sorry that they threw out their comics when they were kids. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I was drawing as far back as I can remember. And my dad dabbled in art. My dad was a decent kind of cartoony artist style. When I was little, my dad had some serious back problems. He couldn't play ball and sports with me, so we would sit there and draw pictures together at the kitchen table.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that helped get me into art and you know, so I mean, I was just in this very unique, nurturing environment. You know, plus they were cool parents. They were like, Kev, you know, follow your dream, be whatever you want to be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think later in life, until I, you know, got successful, they were like, what have we done? We told him he could be anything. This stupid kid, he wants to be an artist, comic book artist. Who wants to be a comic book artist? You know, because back then, you know, that wasn't a cool thing to be. And, you know, and then, you know, one of my famous stories that I tell people, I don't know if I've mentioned it much on any podcast, is my grandpa was sort of a old world guy who grew up during the Depression.
Mm-hmm.
So he felt I needed to have a backup profession because let's face it, it's hard to be getting into the entertainment business. And so he always wanted, you know, Kev, you know, as you're getting ready to go to college, and he was a cool guy in that, you know, he gave me some money for my first year in art school.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he just couldn't believe that I could make it in the entertainment business of any kind. And so it was like, you know, his idea of having a backup plan, having a backup profession is plumber, carpenter,
mm-hmm.
you know, attorney, you know, that kind of thing, auto mechanic, which I am not mechanically inclined. You don't want me to build anything with wood or nails. So one day I come to realize that, you know, hey, I've got this other talent. So I would visit my grandpa for an hour or two every Sunday after church. And then one Sunday I come in and I'm like, and it was like springtime or beginning of summer. So the windows were open and we lived right next door to my grandparents. Mm-hmm. So my dad could hear this conversation. And I'm like, Grandpa, I've got good news. I figured out what my backup plan will be. And he's like, that's great, Kevin. What is it? And I'm like, but I can't make it as an artist. I'll be a writer. And my grandpa's already old and frail, right? And he like leaps out of his chair and leans over. He's like, oh my God, the only thing worse than an artist is a writer.
And then you proceeded to have a very lucrative career doing both.
Yeah.
Yep, exactly. And my dad was cool. So like I was a little flummoxed by that, but I'm like, okay, sorry to disappoint you. And I'm walking back to my house and my dad meets me in the backyard and he's like, Kev, I heard what grandpa said. It's like, you don't listen to that old man. You follow your dream. You want to be an artist, you be an artist. You want to be a writer, you be a writer. And I'm like, well, thanks, Dad. He wasn't going to derail me. But I mean, I appreciate your support. I mean, it was very sweet. I mean, he was really serious about that. You know, he gave me a big hug and I'm like, it's okay, Dad. I'm good.
Yeah. You know,
so I was super fortunate. We were poor, but, you know, the house was full of love and good things. And my mom and dad were just creative in their own kind of way. Very, very nurturing environment. So, I mean, I was able to run wild with my ideas. You know, they never sat back and said bad things about stuff. Like one of my aunts at one point, my aunt Irene, she's like, you're such a great artist, but all you draw is monsters and superheroes.
And I'm like, turns out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Go right ahead.
Well, this is tangential, and I'm derail things every now and then. Who's the boxer in your family, or are you the boxer in your family? Because if you're ever taking skills and it allows it, you're gonna take the boxer.
Nobody's actually a boxer.
Okay.
We had a famous the Kronk gym was a famous mm-hmm. boxing gym that was in my neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Tommy Hearns and a bunch of other guys boxed there. And then Kevin Long got me into boxing in the early 80s.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
yeah. Or mid 80s, I guess, as a spectator.
Mm-hmm.
I've never actually boxed, but I found boxing fascinating. I guess I'd kind of discovered it a little before because that plays a huge role in my combat system.
Mm-hmm.
Watching how boxers box. I mean, that's where the idea of SDC came from. So I guess, you know, part of it, like a lot of the nation, I was enthralled with Muhammad Ali before Kevin Long got me into boxing.
Yeah.
You know, Muhammad Ali and Frazier and mm-hmm. you know, George Foreman, And I really studied, like I said, I look, that's why I tell people, think outside the box, look at everything, let everything give you ideas. And so I'd watch boxing and you'd see these guys, you know, they look like they're getting the crap beat out of them. And then all of a sudden, boom, boom, boom. And he knocks the other guy out. And you're like, well, holy crap. You know, and I started to think, you know, SDC came about because I'm thinking, you know, if one of you guys punched me in the stomach right now, I'm going to double over. I'm going to be like, can't catch my breath. But, you know, the four of us could probably pummel on someone like Mike Tyson when he's at his peak. Mm-hmm. And he would just brush it all off and turn around and clean our clocks.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, and it, that's SDC in action.
Yeah.
Yep. You know, he'd still clean our clocks.
Yeah.
Yeah. One punch for that guy, we'd be out cold.
Yeah.
So, you know, and that's also real life examples of, you know, it drives me crazy sometimes when people talk about game balance, mm-hmm. Or a lack of game balance in our games, because as you guys pointed out earlier, you know, you can play a sleuth or you can play Thor.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, and for some people that's broken because, you know, what's the sleuth going to do? Well, you know, he can do lots of things if the game master is, you know, keeping him in mind and making sure he has stuff to do. You want a guy who's a brainiac. You want a guy who is going to notice clues and figure stuff out and, you know, notice what could be a trap or an ambush versus the guy who can, you know, in video game terms, you know, you have the tank. Mm-hmm. The tank is cool. You want him on your team, but he's not necessarily the guy to figure stuff out and do stuff. You know, I want that range. I want, you know, those capabilities. I want to have all kinds of characters in there that can just, you know, fit whatever people want. I mean, you come on, you guys have gamed for years. You know, mm-hmm. there are players who always play a particular type of character. They're always the mage or always is a smart guy. And then there's the guy who is the tank or the healer or whatever. And that's all fine. But I want to give people options to play whatever they want. And also want to give people options to try other things. Mm-hmm. You know, it's fun to try different types of characters that you might not think you would enjoy playing.
Yeah, I love the low power options.
Yeah.
That just, when you have to think instead of like pointing your shiny boom gun at things, it just brings a richer game.
I've always enjoyed the style of play that comes from random character rolling. Mm-hmm. If I will sit down at a table to play in somebody's game, and if it has random rolling, I like it because that means I don't have to think too hard about what I want to play before I sit down. I can be like, okay, Hobgoblin, that looks pretty cool. I'm going to roll these stats. All right. Oh, this guy could be a so-and-so or whatever. And then let that guide me into someone interesting that did not exist before I sat down and rolled those dice.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, everyone has their own style of play. So I've played with characters, or I should say I've gamed with players who would claim, I just randomly rolled this. And I'm like, wow, really? Four stats that are, you know, 22 or higher? That was some pretty sweet rolling. Mm-hmm. But I don't care. I don't care that they picked it. If that's what they want to play, if that's how they want to do it, that's fine because I want them to have fun. But I agree with you guys. They're missing out on, now I got to think about it. One of the most memorable characters that in fact, there's two really memorable characters. One was an NPC that I played in Palladium Fantasy, and another one was a Julius Rosenstein character, also from Palladium Fantasy. And Julius liked to just do random rolls. Mm-hmm. So he rolls up this character that's a wolfen. And he's a badass. He's got, you know, great speed. He's got great strength. He's got decent, 18 physical prowess and an IQ of 6.
Yeah.
And he named him Fang. And Fang was just this great. He played him like very simple. I don't mean like a simpleton, but kind of simple and straightforward. And the character was just so sincere and heroic that everybody loved this character. And, you know, a lot of people would go, IQ of 6, that's unplayable. You know, and Julius being a great player, he would, you know, have his character make faux pas, especially in social situations or do something dumb. Like one of Fang's favorite characters, or favorite characters, favorite weapons, was an oak chair. Because they got in combat, and their weapons had to get left out someplace, and they're getting ambushed, and he grabs his big-ass chair, and he just wipes the floor with the bad guys using this chair, and he's like, oh, this is a great weapon. He straps it to his back.
Nice.
And he carried a stupid chair around forever.
Yeah, that makes me want to give a shout out. I'm currently running a Palladium Fantasy First Edition campaign on weekends. And two characters, I watched the players roll these characters, resulted in actually really high stats. And something else. So first we have the kobold. The kobold priest is probably the most badass character I've ever seen naturally rolled in a Palladium game. Really, really fast, really, really strong. just runs up. The kobold priest with a knife is the damage dealer of the group. Whereas there's the elven knight, Keith. Keith is beautiful. He's quick. He's strong. And he's dumb as a box of hair. He has IQ of 6. I think there's another character in the group who has like an IQ of 7 that Keith considers a brilliant genius. And watching them roleplay these characters as just these unique creatures in a world is wonderful. It fills my heart with joy.
It is wonderful. And it also makes for great moments. There was this one game I'm playing with, of course, Alex and Kevin Long and Stumps and a bunch of guys, and you know, stuff is going on. It happened to be fantasy also. And Alex says, I forget the name of his character. My character, who was a changeling and had changed to look like a demon, like a pandemonium. Mm-hmm. And he's like, I'm going to run across to join the battle. And I go, great, Alan. I go, wait a minute, what's your speed again? And he's like, 4. And I'm like, yeah, you see this pandemonium slowly strolling across the battlefield, smoking a pipe, you know, and it's like everyone laughs. It's this great moment of levity in this very dramatic battle scene. And, you know, it's great.
I like interpreting roles that way, too. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't always have to interpret everything. Oh, I didn't roll high enough. You failed. Oh, yeah. I rolled high enough. You succeeded. There's always a lot more there, you know. Mm-hmm. Like again, our fantasy sessions. The priest had summoned a gargoyle. Gargoyles are badass, and this is a low level group. Summon this gargoyle that they fully expected to just wipe the floor with every other creature that was attacking them. The gargoyle failed every single one of its combat rolls. It just kept failing everything.
I remember
so this. Much that Jacob, who's in my game, starts coming up with this story about how the gargoyle didn't know he was on call that weekend. Therefore, he was still in the bathtub, and it's just like, what's going on? Oh, no.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
That's great. You know, and but that's also why I hate like luck rolls, mm-hmm. because the luck is in the dice.
Yeah. Yep. There's already a mechanic.
And I love it. You know, yeah, you've got, you know, some bad guy or some creature you summon and he rolls like garbage. I sit back and go, it's fate. It's part of the story. It's supposed mm-hmm. to go this way. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's also epic when, you know, that guy rolls the natural 20 and takes down, you know, mm-hmm. the big bad guy. I mean, how many games can you say that, you know, someone does a heroic action and the whole group jumps up and cheers?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's...
Yeah, without the failures, great. The successes mean nothing. So...
And that's the thing. That's what I love about role-playing. Mm-hmm. You know, try playing a different role. Don't look at your character and go, oh, my God, he's awful. I mean, another great story is I'm running this game and the player is a great player. He's come to the open house, I think every open house, Isaac, and we're at some other convention, I think. It wasn't the open house, and we're playing a Beyond the Supernatural game. And I have these pre-rolled characters, and one of the characters is like this 80-year-old, you know, Professor Higgins. Mm-hmm. And the group confronts these bad guys. They're playing great, but they find themselves in a jam. I mean, and they're screwed. It's like, I, as a game master, I'm thinking, OK, okay, what bone can I throw them so they can survive? And I'm thinking, man, they're all about to die. There's nothing anyone can do. And the big bad guys, you know, this arrogant jerk, and Professor Higgins asks him to, you know, can you at least, you know, tell us what your plan is before you kill us, you know, horrendously. And the guy starts going on and on, and he's like, I've got a pen in my pocket, right? A fountain pen. And I'm like, yeah. And he's like, so I'm carefully taking off the cap, and I'm doing it very slowly so no one notices what I'm doing. And I'm like, okay. And I have no idea where this is going yet. And he's like, yeah, and I'm going to like slowly pull it out. Does anyone notice what I'm doing? And I'm like, nah, if any of the demons or henchmen notice, they're like, yeah, big deal. He's got a pen in his hand. You know, he's asking for an autograph. What? I don't know. You know, not going to worry about it. And he's like, and we're standing really close. I mean, like with an arm's length, right? I said, yeah, closer. Because the big bad guy at one point leans, you know, nose to nose. And is like, you guys are fools. You know, we have you now. How could you think you could defeat us? And he's like, all right. You know, I'm very educated. I understand. I'm not a doctor, but I mean, I understand physiology and anatomy. And he goes, I want to stab him in the neck in his jugular vein. The guy rolls a natural 20.
Oh, damn.
And in situations like that, I like to let the bad guy react. So I'm like, okay, I mean, unless he matches your roll of a natural 20, I roll like a 5. Mm-hmm. You know, and he's like, pulls it out. Blood is like squirting out like a fountain. You know, the big bad villain, you know, cult leader is like, you know, his followers, including the demons, are like, what happened? What happened? You know, this is as non-combat guy as you can get. Mm-hmm. And the player was just really thinking. He took a wild stab at
literally
turned a tide of the whole thing, you know, because without the, you know, the guy falls over dead in a minute, you know, and you know, his henchmen are all like, you know, the demons are like, hey, the guy who's controlling us, he's dead. We get to leave or go off into the world and cause mayhem. Cool. You know, they don't give a shit about him. So there's no, I'm going to avenge the master. No, they're like, yeah, great. I'm out of here.
Yeah.
So speaking of turning the tide, when Ninjas and Super Spies came out, I had a lot of friends who were active in martial arts. I had dabbled a little bit, but I came from the wrong side of the tracks and money was not paying for martial art classes in our house.
Yeah. I hear you.
And over the years, the folks I've introduced Ninjas and Super Spies to who actually have either martial arts or combat sports backgrounds, like I did in the 90s, have always been very impressed with the combat system. Because beyond the special martial arts powers, which whoever was the Hong Kong cinema a file in the office was definitely doing their homework on Ninjas and Super Spies. But the very small but important change of melee range for combat has been like when I'm talking to folks who have actual fight experience or like myself or mixed martial arts or traditional martial arts, it's that small but important change really makes the game what it is. So many role-playing games have tried to do martial arts and then try to figure out how to balance out so people just aren't constantly spamming most powerful attack and that stuff. Was that all Eric's work, or was that a group thing of how to modify the Palladium combat rules with these small tweaks that made it so a Wing Chun short ranger could actually hold their own with a Taekwondoist who's going to just stand at long range and try to kick you over and over again? Where did that thought stream come from?
It was sort of both of us. Again, part of what we do is research the shit out of everything. And then Eric, in fact, you mentioned Taekwondo. I think that was one of Eric's, that was his third martial arts. Mm-hmm. So Eric had some firsthand experience with that. Julius was a third degree black belt in Aikido. So we would talk to actual martial artists. We would watch them perform. We would watch, as you pointed out, Hong Kong movies and stuff. I was a big Bruce Lee fan.
Mm-hmm. Heck yeah.
And we would research things like crazy and then try to incorporate. And that actual change in the rules was Eric, but we talked about it. And I said, yeah, Eric, it makes total sense. That's why, for, you know, if you read a lot of our games, there's little tweaks, little nuances, little changes for that particular setting, mm-hmm. because it makes sense. And so, yeah, that was mostly Eric. But yeah, and I had to go through it. Like, it was like, I still think some of the bonuses are a little high, but Eric Eric really wanted to go that way, and that's reduced. I went down and reduced everything. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we really, really like to discuss things. We have a different approach to stuff. Like, it was interesting. We recently had a Zoom meeting with Sophie Campbell, because she's writing one of the adventures that will be the digital bonus adventure. We wanted to see if we could surprise people and have it actually into one of the books, but she's just so slammed right now. She can't. Mm-hmm. And I had Sean sitting in with me, and she's like, well, how do you want to do this? You want me to write an outline? Do you want to write an outline, Kevin? Cause we're supposed to write it together. And I said, I like to work kind of differently. Yes, we'll want an outline eventually, but I said, let's just spitball ideas and talk about where things could go, what we want to do. She was like, oh, okay, I've never really worked that way, but let's give it a shot. By the end, it was just great. And she's like, I love this, because it's very collaborative, because none of us, the way I kind of work, and in my mind, this kind of ties back to comic books and Heroes Unlimited. I always heard stories about how Stan Lee worked, where he would sit down with his artist, like we are now, talking together, and they would spitball ideas, and he'd give them a plot outline of what he was thinking. And then the artist would turn into art, and he'd look at it and go, yeah, this is pretty good, but change this page, change this panel. And then the artist would go in, finish it up, and turn it in, and Stan would then go in and write the actual dialogue. And it was much more cooperative than a fully finished script handed to somebody to illustrate. And I always thought that was kind of cool, being a Marvel head, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, and I like that approach. I actually had someone involved in Hollywood say that I think and function very much like a director, which is very cooperative. And I've heard directors talk, you know, give interviews and talk, and the really great ones are like, yeah, I don't give a crap where the idea comes from. I don't care if it's from the cleaning guy, from, you know, the boom operator, from Aunt Matilda. You know, if it's a great idea, then I'm going to try to incorporate it. And that's the way I work. I mean, I get excited by the ideas. And so, like Sophie mentioned some stuff. And the cool thing of that is, like Sophie said, you know, I had this idea for this and that. I don't know what you're going to think of it. And, you know, I've got this character and I want to name him this. And I'm like, oh, that's great. And then she's like, yeah, I was thinking of doing this. And we're like, I don't know about that. And Sean's like, how about this? And she's like, oh, that would be great. And I'm like, oh, I love it. And at the end, we had this great thing, you know, and she's going to sit down and write it. And I'm going to go over it and tweak it and add stuff that I think needs to be added if necessary. And I mean, she's a master role player. And she's a, you know, runs like 3 or 4 freaking games every week, mostly our stuff. So I think it's going to be excellent. She's an outstanding writer. But it was just fun when you have, especially really capable people, really creative people, it's a blast. You know, I'm retweaking a Palladium adventure for Yin Sloth Expeditions that John Klinkel wrote. You know, I was telling Sean about some of it, and, you know, he goes, you know, maybe don't make that a sword. Why don't you make it maybe, you know, considering what the character is, maybe make it a pick. Maybe it's a dual pick, because there's like snake ties in this guy. It's like a minion of Pith. You know, and I'm like, oh yeah, and I can make it look like fangs. And then, you know, he had this other idea that I like, you know, and it's like haters and jerk-offs have tried to peg me as a control freak. And anyone who's actually worked with me knows, you know, yes, I'm a control freak in the sense of if you're doing something that's totally out of line with, you know, the setting or the characters or the power, then I'm going to say, yeah, what the hell are you thinking, Matt? Stop it. But if it's a great idea, I want it, and I want you to be excited. And we want, for me, and this is true of like apparently a lot of really good directors of films, is ultimately I want the best product.
Yeah.
I want something that's going to be the most fun for the players. Again, I don't care where that idea comes from or who comes up with it. You know, Chuck Walton used to be surprised by that because I guess he worked with a guy who not only would steal people's ideas, he'd take all the credit.
Mm-hmm. Rude.
And, or poo-poo stuff. You know, if it's a great idea, it's a great idea. I want it. Yeah. You know? So sorry, I kind of went off on a tangent.
No.
We're actually not here for the tangents.
We're here for the tangents, as are most of our listeners. How was Ninjas and Super Spies received when it hit the market?
I wasn't sure how it would go because no one else had ever done anything like it. Mm-hmm. Not really. And, you know, there's Bushido, but that's a period game and it's
really good.
But it's, you know, so I wasn't sure how that would go. And it was great. It sold very, very well.
Yeah. If I'm correct, the only supplement that ever came out for it was Mystic China, correct?
Yep, that is true.
Which, as a guess...
With a great Steranko cover.
Yeah, amazing cover. But who in who did you hire that was super into Taoist folklore for that?
So here's the a couple of interesting stories. So... This cover was actually drawn. It was supposed to be the cover to Villains Unlimited.
Oh.
And Steranko turned this in. Jim Steranko was into pulp stuff and like The Shadow and you know, Fu Manchu and that kind of stuff. And I get this great painting. And it's funny, back in the day, I mean, he would actually mail me the frickin' painting. And then we'd get transparency shot of it and stuff. But so I get this astonishing painting and Eric comes running over. And on one hand, we're like, wow, that's amazing. On the other hand, we're like, wow, that's not Heroes Unlimited or Villains Unlimited. I'm like, so we got to do something with this because, I mean, I want it. I love this painting. I want to use it. And I'm like, Eric, why don't you write a book? We'll call it Mystic China. You can extrapolate on all the powers and stuff in there. And Eric's like, I'm more of a Japanese guy. I don't know much about China. And I'm like, Eric, you're this great writer. Just do a little research. You'll bang it out.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess my pitch was so good. He's like, okay. And he walked out of my house thinking, how am I going to write this? I don't know anything about the Chinese culture.
Mm-hmm.
So like I said, we research like crazy. When I say we do research, I mean, we read like hundreds of flipping books.
Yeah.
And try to really capture the culture, the mythology, the, you know, and find the cool stuff, you know, the wow factor and all this stuff. So Eric deep dived, and Eric's a maniac. So he deep dives into Chinese culture and reads, I don't know how many hundreds of books, to the point where he's actually going to the University of Michigan and getting permission to see their archival books that you cannot take out of the library. And he fell in love with China to the point where, A, he wrote a great book. B, he would spend like 10 years living in China.
Mm-hmm.
Because he loved it and got work as an adjunct professor at the University of Hong Kong, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And then as a video game designer in working in the Hong Kong branch of Ubisoft. Yeah, he would have, because of this book, he would have this love of China that to the point where he actually moved there and lived there for a freaking decade.
I never knew that.
It's amazing. Yeah, he never told me either, because I'm always very gung-ho and high energy, right? Mm-hmm. And in my youth, even more so. Eric once said that I was like a runaway train going 90 miles an hour, and so you can't stop that train, but you can, if you're smart, you can derail, not derail, but steer, switch tracks, yeah, and put me on another track and let me run down that trail and those ideas, and maybe slow me down because mm-hmm. it's going up a hill. So for me, I was just like, yeah, Eric, you can do this. Mm-hmm. Kev, I don't know if I can. Yeah, of course you can. But Kev, no, Eric, you're brilliant. You're a genius. You can do this. Okay. I didn't realize. I mean, I felt kind of bad later because I'm like, oh, so I kind of railroaded mm-hmm. you into that. I said, I didn't mean to do that. And he's like, Kev, it worked out great. I love China.
It's funny because Mystic China is probably the only RPG book that my father ever did more than flip through. My parents were totally supportive of my role playing. Both my parents were huge Tolkien fans, yeah, and that. But my father, when he had been going to university, basically had an undeclared minor in Asian studies with an emphasis on China and how Taoism affected, yeah, China culture and drove the Three Kingdoms period, et cetera, et cetera. He stole this one. This is one of two items I had to go into his stuff and retrieve. The other one being my Guns N' Roses tape.
Oh, fair enough.
Because he just loved how well a certain period of Taoist folklore was really taken. And he described this book as 80s martial arts movies got crossed over with Big Trouble in Little China. And that's
high praise. High praise.
Yeah, and he meant it as high praise too.
And that was sort of our goal.
Yeah.
So he nailed exactly what we were trying to do. Eric and I loved Big Trouble in Little China.
It's
it's an amazing supplement. You know, for one of your game systems that only got one support book, mm-hmm. like amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. You knocked it out of the park with.
Well, that was Eric. Was. Yeah, that book is very much Eric. All I did was go through and edit it. It's like 100% Eric Woodjick. Mm-hmm. Where Ninjas and Super Spies is about 80% Eric and 20% me. And Ninja Turtles is like 80-90%. The writing is like 90-95% Eric. The game rules are about 60-40, 60% Eric. Because a lot of them were my ideas. And that was a great thing working with Eric, is we were always, seemed like we were always on like the same wavelength. And we'd get each other excited.
Yeah.
So, you know, we'd walk away from a conversation just chomping at the bit to dive right in and start writing and developing game rules and playtesting. Which was beautiful. And I didn't realize how rare that was until Eric passed away. And that's why when I found it with Sean Robertson, I'm like, I'm bringing this guy in. I even was hiring. He's my partner. He's the next guy. He's the guy who's going to carry on because he's got the passion and we're on the same wavelength and mm-hmm. super rare.
Yeah.
It was a beautiful thing.
I love, you know, it's a little trite to say after that beautiful thing you just said. But I love the cover because it reminds me of an old, like, Remo Williams, Doc Savage cover.
Yeah.
And, yes! And like,
that's exactly what it is.
It's brilliant. I would see this in the dollar, like, paperback bookstore and I would have picked it up. Mm-hmm. And if I had seen a cover like this, I would go, oh, that's cool. Mm-hmm. And I love that it's by, Steranko.
Yep.
It's an amazing cover.
Steranko did a lot of shadow covers for the mm-hmm. novels, mm-hmm. and I think a few Doc Savage. Mm-hmm.
Oh, so I'm not out of pocket there. That
No, you're dead on. That's exactly what it was. Stranko grew up. Stranko is a little younger than my dad, but I mean, he grew up on the pulps, loved that stuff. We would see him at conventions, you know, buying up pulp magazines and stuff in the 70s. Mm-hmm. And he loved that stuff.
Excellent.
So that's exactly what it was. It was his homage. And that's what I said. And this is a great example of everything gives me ideas.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, we get a cover that's just not superhero mm-hmm. or super villain. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's villainous and intriguing and amazing. And then you look at it and all kinds of ideas start to pop into your head.
It looks so 70s movie poster, too, in a way.
It screams novel to me, honestly.
Yeah, it does. It does. The interior art on it is really good as well.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Well, let's move to final thoughts for this era here. We've done heroes, ninjas, and super spies, and you're starting. You've made your moves, and this is where you're going now. You're not going into the Kimiko verse or Coleco Vision verse.
Yeah.
Right. You're going in this direction that is solid and that's nailed down. Where do we go next? What's the next bit?
The next thing is Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
And this is where you really just explode, huh?
Yep. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Well, one of the things I really wanted to build my company and I wanted to enhance our distribution. And we'll talk about this some more in the next episode, but I always say there's only three reasons to get a license. I think I mentioned this in the last episode too. And it's and any one of these reasons is good. You love it. It's going to make you a pile of money and or it's going to open up doors for you. And I knew if we got Ninja Turtles, we could get into the comic book stores.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And same thing with Robotech. And so it was very deliberate and calculated. And in the case of both Turtles and Robotech, I was very fortunate because I love the IP. I thought it could make us money. Although we didn't know. I mean, Turtles in particular was like brand new. Who knew where that was going to go? But I was confident if we did it right, it would open up new doors for us. And that's where we would go next. But I mean, I didn't know when we finished up, you know, with Heroes Unlimited, I was focused on Palladium Fantasy and Heroes Unlimited. You know, and Turtles just seemed like a natural to go with Heroes Unlimited.
Heroes in a Half Shell.
You know, and that's the thing is like I said, in my memory, issue number 2 came out in like December of 84 and beginning
correct.
Of 85.
Yeah.
And so, you know, again, it was just perfect timing. It's six, seven months after the release of Heroes Unlimited. Mm. And I'm like, what's this? This would be cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Kevin. This is, I love these trips. I love these little journeys you take us on. And please do not feel like you have to stay on topic, on tangent. I can feel NPC over there, but I'm the on tangent guy. and I love the stories. And, you know, I want all your fans to hear the stories. So
thanks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about this the next episode, which is TMNT, but I want to give a shout out to Jim Lawson, Steve Levine, and Dan Berger. They were they're some of the original Mirage Studio artists, and they were at a local convention this weekend, and we went to see them. We actually invited them to come to our office, and they were disappointed that he didn't have enough time because the convention was only like 45 minutes away, and it was great seeing those guys. And you know, I'll share some stories next week.
Excellent.
We'll actually have a photo. Thank God, Sean. We were actually leaving. We had said our goodbyes, and Sean's like, "Oh shoot, we need to get a photo of us with the guys." And I'm like, "Absolutely." So that'll appear in the weekly update. I'll probably talk about that.
Excellent.
Speaking of which, as we're wrapping up here, any news or from Palladium you want to share and make sure our listeners are up to speed on?
The backer kit for the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, the pledge manager, that should go up soon. Sean and I have been a little frustrated that it's taking so long for it to go up. We're trying to nail down shipping rates that are going to be accurate. And we wanted to set it up so that when you made your pledge, you could pay for the shipping all at one time.
Yeah.
And poor Wayne Smith, while he's recuperating from his knee surgery, busted his behind to try to do that. And then our because we're shipping, there's so many going out that we actually bringing in a third party fulfillment company to do it for us. And this guy actually called us up when he heard we were planning to do this and begged us not to nail down the shipping rates because things are changing. And he's like, look, it's going to ship, you know, 4 or 5 months from now. You know, God knows what the shipping situation will be. I guess, you know, there's stuff going on with the Suez Canal and Panama Canal. And, you know, hopefully everything will be fine, not just so we can ship on time and have, you know, low prices for shipping, but so there's not new wars and strife in the world.
Yeah.
We don't need that crap. So that should go up. Sean will kill me by saying, I hope sometime next week.
Yeah.
But I hope it'll be sometime next week. Oh, see, here he is. He heard it.
Hey, Sean.
How y'all doing?
We're doing great.
You would not believe the promises Kevin just made.
Oh, Kevin. Should I come?
He's lying, Sean.
Hope you guys are having a good time chatting.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Good to see you.
No problem. I was going to say, time's up, guys.
Yeah.
is there anything we want to say? I was just saying, you know, the Pledge Manager backer kit should hopefully go up very soon.
Yeah. And I just, you know, that's one of those things that's really important to us. But of course, we have different lines of people working on different stuff. So Wayne and Christopher Landauer have been working really hard on finalizing that and getting it up for everybody to see. We also want to make sure that we have reasonably accurate as of right now shipping projections available
for
everyone. And so that it has been I guess the toughest part of the cookie to crack for our guys, but you know, because Kevin and I are really focusing on production and stuff on the books, so that's kind of how that's been going. We wanted it to be up a couple of weeks ago, but it should be very soon. We're finalizing a lot of stuff, but it's just complicated. It's really complicated math. And I mean, I don't know if I could go on for a while about the EU and UK and VAT and all the different countries. And it's but we're working with really great, sharp people. And it looks like we're going to Spiral Galaxy again and some other
For overseas.
Again. So they were very popular last time. So,
and then ArcTrans is going to be our fulfillment company for domestic Canada.
And Canada. And they have part of that's because they're really great for Canada.
Yeah.
Besides, they have a great reputation. And, you know, the guy running the show there is a big Palladium fan.
Yeah.
And reached out to us during Titan Robotics. He's like, can I help you? What can I do? You know, he's like, I didn't even ever think of talking to you about this until I heard you guys were having trouble with another shipping partner. So, but no, he's been awesome. And we're really looking forward to things. And can't wait to show off a lot of the miniature sculpts and stuff.
Yeah. Yes.
A lot of it's going to be available.
Yes. Yeah. We'll talk about that in our next, the next subject is, TMNT, so I'm biting my tongue.
Oh, sorry. I didn't mean to jump in. that's part of the big things. I was talking to a fan. We were at this con yesterday. I don't know if Kev mentioned it to you.
Yes, he did.
It was just like, I was like, yeah, by the end of this, I think I'll have 3 months of just pure coordinating art and for art direction and approvals. And that goes for Kev too. He's been working on this for months, you know, lining up all these artists and so it's been great, but just really busy. So,
well, part of it, you know, it's not a matter of Palladium doing the approvals, you know, we have to get approvals from Paramount. And so we've got something like 30 artists contributing, you know, tribute pages. And so the thing is, you know, that sounds like a lot, but then you got to think, okay, so first they've got to submit 3 sketches that Paramount has to approve.
Yeah, Paramount picks one of the sketches,
and then maybe they've got feedback,
and we'll tell them which sketch we like as well. Yeah. But the whole point is, and there's a lot of good reasons for it. We got a lot of rabbits, for instance. People like mutant rabbits. I don't know.
Oh, really? Rabbits, you say.
And then they have to do, you know, the artist has to submit the final pencils, and you go through approval for that. And then you got to submit the final inks, and you get approvals on that. Mm-hmm. And then, so.
And there might be feedback that goes back and
forth. Right, back and forth. And then you get the color. So, I mean, that's 30 artists times like 4 or 5 or 6 steps. It's a ton of work.
But, you know, Kevin and I are talking about it. I mean, it's just so worth it for this product. Because I told Kevin, I was like, I'm never doing this again. But it's so worth it for the turtles.
Yeah.
It's a really special event. And so we really wanted to do this with these. I know it's a book, not an event. But for us, it's a huge event.
Well, it is sort of an event. Because
I mean, the Kickstarter itself was an event, right?
And it's the 40th anniversary this year of TMNT. Right. You know, I can't, and we can talk about more of this next week, or next time we have a meeting, for the podcast. But you know, these guys, you know, Jim Lawson and Steve Levine and Dan Berger, they were just so happy that we included them, and we're like, of course we would include you guys. I mean, you're part of the original.
Yeah.
The original team.
It's just been tough to wrangle with everything else going.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, no, we're really excited about everything getting set up. And I don't mean to derail everything, but I just want to jump in and say hi to you guys.
No, it's great to see you, man.
I'm glad that you have a competent backer kit partner and a fulfillment partner. Having heard some of the horror stories of folks in Canada, our 228 listeners from Canada on the last episode will be incredibly happy to hear that you have someone who's competent at the helm.
Yeah. And you know, and some companies have different abilities, right? And so we're trying to make sure that we're using the pinch hitters. Like Spiral Galaxy they just nailed it, especially with the UK and the EU. And that can, like I said, it's a whole nother thing. I mean, each country needs stuff filed in their language, right? And they all have different rates,
VATs, terms,
different items that they'll tax different ways. I mean, it's insanity. Yeah. And so they were great for that. But you know, I think that we're looking at working with Jeff Sheets at ArcTrans, and ArcTrans is really great for the Canadian side of things, shipping from the U.S.
Yeah.
And you know, we know that was a big pain point for a lot of people. And so, yeah, we're just looking to just smooth out everything we can, the best we can. And, awesome. You know, you hope for the best. It's not always perfect. And shipping especially is always changing. So we can't, we're going to have to wait to charge the shipping and things like that. But we're trying to get really, really accurate estimates as of right now.
They know what they're
looking for. Yeah, so, you know, it could go up, could go down a little bit, but it should be a right in there. It
could go up a little bit, but, you know, we don't know. And another thing, hopefully people realize is that these books are heavy. You know, they're hardcovers on paper. So,
and that does add up weight compared to, you know, the perfect bound books that you might be used to. So anyway, it's all pretty good. Fortunately, the minis aren't very super heavy, and you know,
and they're amazing,
but anyway, everything adds up. A lot of fans are getting a lot of stuff. So, I think in the end though, they're going to be really happy with, and you'll be able to tell that you're getting a good deal. We're shaking our moneymaker to try and make sure that happens. So, and that's one of the great things about bringing in Chris Landauer. That's one of the great things about having Wayne work on this stuff is we can get these good deals while Kevin and I are still able to focus on production.
Yeah. Well, that sounds super awesome. And I'm glad that we're going to be able to let our folks know that it's coming real soon and the light is starting to appear at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah, it should be super soon. And of course, we have to get, you know, we'll do an official update on the Kickstarter. We have to get that approved with Paramount, you know, and just hopefully fans understand that it's not just the same as us making a comment in a forum or something or on a podcast offhand. But yeah. And the other thing is that, you know, a little bit of delay there hasn't slowed down the production on the books themselves and the coordination with artists and stuff. So just so fans understand that it's not like there's some log jam behind the scenes they don't know about. So. Yeah.
Excellent.
Okay. Excellent.
Well, thank you so much.
I'll leave you guys to it.
Yep.
It was good chatting. Cheers.
Talk to you later.
Cheers. Well, thanks again for joining us, Kevin. And thanks, Sean, for jumping in and giving us all of that awesome information, which we are excited to talk about in greater detail
in just a moment. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Me too. I'm happy because, you know, it seems like a lot of interviews we do is always on what's the latest, and that's cool, and we're happy to talk about that. But it's nice to be able to go in depth about, you know, what we were thinking or what I was thinking at the time when we were originally making a book, you know, 30 or 40 freaking years ago.
I don't know if you realize how much of a touchstone for my generation specifically your books were. D&D was a thing. BattleTech was kind of a thing. But everyone was talking about Rifts, Robotech, and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. And that was something that could go to our cafeteria in our book bag with our mismatched dice, and we could play. And it was a huge, huge deal. And yeah, I get in the culture we have now, everyone wants to hear about what's coming, what's new, what's next, produce. But I think there is a bit of people out there who want to hear the history of it. And I think it's great. And I thank you so much for taking this time with us.
Yeah. Well, I agree with you. You know, obviously at the time that we were making the stuff, we had no idea what a profound impact we were having on our audience. But in you know, recent years, I'm just shocked and humbled by the impact we have had on so many people, and how much our work has inspired people. I mean, you know, and like the big name people, you know, the founder of Blizzard.
Yeah.
You know, they flew me in 2010 to talk to their workers, their community, about world building. And, you know, they had their whole own little auditorium, and, you know, there's like 350 people come to hear me talk about world building. I'm like, holy crap. And then I walk into the founder's office, and there's a shelf full of my books, you know, Mechanoids, Robotech, you know, Heroes Unlimited, a whole bunch of stuff. And I'm like, holy crap, you play my stuff? He's like, are you kidding? You are my inspiration. Aww. And I'm like, what? Can I get a percentage of Blizzard?
It's not what it used to be, but I mean, it's still something.
You know, it was amazing. You know, Ross Marshall Thurber, you know, he's becoming a big shot director. He's working on the D&D streaming series. He, you know, did Red Notice, which was the most watched original Netflix movie ever. He's done a bunch of other stuff. You know, we meet and he tells me how, you know, I'm the reason he's a writer director, because he realized playing Ninja Turtles and Heroes Unlimited and Rifts that he loved telling stories.
Yeah. And the stories just like they tend to resonate, especially with my group. And I think that's where we should probably leave it, is just that. It's like we've sat and we've gotten it, and it's just, God, I'm just really glad you're doing this. Thanks, Kevin. Yeah, thanks, Kevin.
Me too. Thank you for doing it.
Yeah.
I'm very grateful.
Yeah.
Yep.
So let's call it here. We'll see you next week, is it next week?
Not quite certain. We'll work out the details.
Yeah. Yeah. But again, thanks so much, Kevin. Thank all of you out there, all of our listeners. And we'll be doing this again. And this trip down memory lane for all of us has been wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks again. Cool.
Starships, magic, mystic martial arts, romance. All of these can be found in A Cloak of Blades by Isaac Scher. You might have heard my name before. I've done a lot of voiceover work for Breakfast Puppies. And I've recently released my first novel. It's available on Amazon as an ebook and paperback, and you can get it for free if you have a Kindle Unlimited subscription. I do hope you'll support my work as you're supporting Breakfast Puppies, and it's been a pleasure talking with you today. Have a good one.
You've been listening to The Glitter Boys, a Palladium Books fan podcast. Glitter Boys, Rifts, the Megaverse, and all other such topics are the property of Kevin Sambita and Palladium Books.
Please buy all their stuff and help keep them in print and making more games. You can order directly at palladiumbooks.com, and their entire catalog is available digitally at DriveThruRPG as well. Our opening music is 8-Bit Bass and Lead by Furby Guy from freesound.org. This closing music is Caravana by Philip Gross, available at freemusicarchive.org. All sound effects used are self-made or acquired via Creative Commons Zero License. If you like what you have heard, find us on Twitter and Facebook as The Glitter Boys. That's B-O-I-S. And check us out online at breakfastpuppies.com/glitterboys. And also join us on the Breakfast Puppies Network Discord at breakfastpuppies.com/discord. And if you want to help us out, please spread the word and help us build a community. Thanks again for listening. We'll catch you next time.